Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, June 11th. I'm Ray Graff. Time once again for another science forum on the show. We have two experts on the line to field your scientific inquiries. The number to call is 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551 is the phone number. You can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org. That's voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number, if you have a science question, 800-348-2551. Yeah, it's the Science Forum. It comes up right after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. It's the Science Forum today, and we have two scientists on the line to answer your questions. Barbara Brabets is here and Jim Pickett. So what fascinates you? What do you want to know? These are experts, people. Give us a call, 800-348-2551. And if they don't know the answer, they'll just make something up. That's how we work it here on Vox Pop. 800-348-2551. I kid. These are serious people. Our email address is voxpop@wamc.org. voxpop@wamc.org if you want to email your question. But the number is 800-348-2551. Jim Pickett and Barbara Brabets, welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you, Ray.
Thanks, Ray.
It's very tough to do these shows on the phone, and I appreciate you both doing that. Hopefully we will be back with the full complement of scientists in the studio before too long. For those who've never tuned in, Barbara, what is your specialty?
I am a biochemist, and because I teach at SUNY Colville, we don't have a biochemistry department, so I teach both biology and chemistry.
Okay. And your phone is a little dropping in and out. So,
okay.
It's
we'll
not
try that better.
Not that great at the beginning of the show, but we'll make do, right? And Jim Pickett, you are now semi-retired. What is your field of specialty?
I'm an organic chemist.
Aha. Okay, well, you know, on these science shows, and if you've never heard one of these science forums before, people will call in about anything scientific, and our scientists give it a shot, whether it's their specialty or not. Our number is 800-348-2551, and I sent you both an email earlier with a link about Bose-Einstein condensates and this fifth state of matter, and, you know, it's so funny. I was excited about it. My producer was nonplussed by the whole thing, and various other people I talked to said, who cares? But Leo and Gardner called in before the show started, and he wants to talk about it. So, Leo, I'll let you take it from here.
Yeah, this is a very exciting time that we're living in. There's more discoveries now than in, well, anyway, somebody discovered another state of matter. And I'm an astronomer and scientist of sorts, assorted scientist, you might say. And I'm just dying to hear what this new state, or it's probably not new, but what this, it's new to us anyway. What do we know about this? Who knows anything about it?
Well, we know more now. They've done some studies on the International Space Station, and that was the link I sent to our panel today. So, Jim or Barbara, who wants to go first?
Well, I studied up on this a bit. What this state is called is a Bose-Einstein condensate, and it was proposed by Dr. Bose and Einstein about 100 years ago. And, in fact, the first experimental data on it was about 25 years ago here on Earth. Now, what this is kind of the matter equivalent of a laser. The difference between a laser and regular light is that all the waves are in sync. So it's called coherent radiation. Now, so it is behaving like a single light wave. Certain kinds of atoms can get into a quantum state to do something very similar. When they're made very, very cold, so they're not moving relative to each other and held together, they can drop into a state in which all those atoms behave as if they were a single entity. So a single quantum wave function describes that whole assembly.
Now, this is interesting. You have to get near absolute zero to do this, right?
That's right. Very, very close to absolute zero. From what it said on the space station one, they were within a billionth of a degree to absolute zero. So that's pretty chilly.
Yeah. But how? First of all, before we get to this fifth state of matter, which I must confess, I'm not sure exactly how helium-4 figures into this, or whatever they used in this incident. I guess it was what was the atom?
They were using rubidium.
Ah, that's right. Before we get to that, how do you get something that close to absolute zero?
In this case, they had a cloud of the atoms, basically a gas of the atoms, and we're not talking about very much stuff. This is probably a few 100,000 atoms or so. So that's very little matter. And with lasers, they can basically either kick out the more quickly moving atoms, or the atoms that are moving toward the laser can be slowed down. It's kind of called a molasses effect.
Yeah.
So with the lasers, they're able to bring the atoms so that they are essentially not moving very much at all relative to each other.
Now, as I understand it, this was a breakthrough on the ISS because of the much less gravity. They were able to hold this, whatever you call it, this condensate together much longer than they have been able to do on the Earth.
Yeah, and from my studying up on this, the atoms have to be trapped in a magnetic field to sort of hold them together.
Yeah.
And then they need to release that magnetic field, and then they can study this condensate. On Earth, when they release the magnetic field, the atoms immediately start falling due to gravity.
Mm.
So in the space station, since it's basically it's a weightless condition, the atoms can hold in position much longer being a second.
Yeah.
As opposed to millionths or thousandths of seconds.
And quickly, and then we'll take a quick break here, explain to me why this fifth state of matter makes a difference. I understand that there could be some navigation purposes or finding dark energy, but I'm still at a loss as to why this is a huge deal.
Yeah, I don't quite understand that either. I don't understand how it's applied. They were talking about detection of gravitational waves, very precise gravity determinations in order to be able to see sea level rise and that sort of thing. But I don't know how that works.
Well, Leo, thank you for that.
If I could just pop in here for a sec.
Yeah.
One of the things it does do is it allows us to understand the interactions of one subatomic particle with another subatomic particle. So usually we talk about how atoms interact. Certainly that's the basis of chemistry. But when we're down to Bose-Einstein condensates and we're down to such small temperatures and such diffused matter, we get to see how the individual subatomic particles interact. Just for those that are interested, Popular Mechanics had an article that I read up on last fall. Let's see what the date of it is. It was in August of 2019. That is called All the States of Matter That You Didn't Know Existed. And it actually lists much more than five.
But what does this tell us about our concept of reality? The BBC actually covered this today, and I think that their tagline was that it was a window on another reality. And I'm not sure I understood.
Well, I think that goes down to the classical, we have a set of rules that we think matter behaves by. And what we assume is that all matter all the time behaves by those rules. When we start to see these kind of fringe areas where matter isn't quite as heavy as we are in this macro world or as warm as we are in this macro world, we see that those rules are violated. And that's very exciting for science.
Let's take a quick break. Barbara Brabets is here, Jim Pickett is here, and it's the Science Forum. If you have a question, give us a shout, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, or email us at voxpopwamc.org. We'll be right back. Lonnie Smith here, our bumper music on a Vox Pop Science Forum. The number is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. And we have Barbara Brabets here and Jim Pickett on the telephone. And I appreciate you both bearing with us here while we are still doing social distancing. At some point, you'll be back in the studio, and we'll be back to three or four scientists rather than just you two on the phone. I have a couple of emails here. Let me see if I can sift through them very quickly here. Paul wants to know about this fifth state of matter. It's a cavalcade of fifths or pentes. Any way you could, your panel could comment or expand on these? I have no idea what that means.
Well, there aren't just five states of matter. If we want to go and look at those fringes the way we talked about, there are others that we haven't discussed. And, you know, we didn't ask the fundamental question, what are the five that we know of? And it's solid, liquid, gas, plasma, and now this Bose-Einstein condensate. But we also look at what's called degenerate matter and consider that another state of matter. Bose-Einstein condensates are known as bosons. I know that sounds like you're insulting somebody, why not? But there's, if you deal with its opposite, it's called fermions. And so fermions are where the degeneracy of matter comes from. So that's another state that is recognized. Again, it's really, really, really rare and not something that we deal with a daily basis.
The boson is equal number of protons and electrons. Is that what it is?
Well, it really has to do with the quantum number called spin. Nothing's really spinning, I guess. But a boson has a spin that's 0, 1, 2, an integer. The fermions have a spin of multiples of 1/2, or 1/2, 1.5, 2.5. And the deal is that things that are fermions can't have more than one in the same quantum state. Electrons are fermions, and many of the properties of the ordinary matter that's around us is due to the fact that the electrons insist on being in separate quantum states.
Okay. All right. Well, I think Paul might have actually been making a reference to the Circle of Fifths. I think it might have been a musical reference there. I'm not sure. This now will switch gears for an email from Amy in New Paltz, which is much more in my realm of expertise, at least something I would ask. A silly curiosity question for you scientists. Amy writes, if one is able to touch a cloud, does it feel different than the non-clouded air or sky? Now, that's the way I would ask a question.
That's great.
It would be like waving your hand around on a foggy day.
Okay. All right. There you go.
Exactly the same thing.
All right, Amy.
Fog is just ground-based clouds.
This one is from Tige in Chesterfield. I live in Chesterfield. Okay, we've established that. It's a hill town around 1,400 feet. When it is daytime, an AM radio station I listen to comes on fine, but at nighttime, it's all static. Is there a reason that the time of day would affect the signal? Also, I listen to Vox Pop on my way home on FM. Whenever I pass by a particular spot, the radio is interfered by a different broadcast from maybe around 50 to 100 feet. It's a suburban neighborhood near a school. What could cause this interruption every day at the exact same spot? It's from Tige in Chesterfield.
You could probably answer that better than we can.
You know what, Tig? I could give you some thoughts, but we'll wait until Roger, who is a radio engineer and electrical
engineer.
He'll love
to talk about AM interference.
Yes,
and
indeed. And there is
ionosphere.
There are a number of reasons for this, both local and, as you say, up in the ionosphere. So, Tig, hold that thought until Roger is back on. And this one's from Karen. This is a pretty mundane question, Karen writes. I have a small, old-fashioned battery-operated radio. Always wondered if the battery life is shortened if the radio is played at a higher volume versus a lower volume. I often turn the volume down thinking I'm using up the life on the batteries more slowly by doing that. And that's from Karen.
You know, I bet that's true.
That's a great question. Sure. It's power, right? You need to take power.
Yeah. Now, whether it's significant, I don't know, but almost surely it's true. You know, again, whether that extends your battery life by 10 minutes or 6 months, I don't know.
All right, here's another one. Go ahead.
I was going to say, if you think about it, when you have your phone on speakerphone versus when you're talking with headphones like I am right now, you're still putting out power, but because you have to power the speaker and you have to amplify the more for that projection into the room, it certainly uses up your phone battery more.
Sure.
Now, your phone battery is a little bit more sensitive than a pack of D-cell batteries that are in the back of a conventional radio. But yeah, it's the question is, how much significance do you get? Is it, as Jim says, is it a half an hour more, or is it like 3 weeks more?
But the bottom line is our writer is doing the right thing if she wants to save battery by turning the volume down, right?
Right. And if we're ever stuck, like, I don't know, out in the wilderness and we only have so much battery life, then, you know, you turn it on, you listen to the news, and you turn it off. You don't leave it on and listen to tunes waiting for the rescue helicopter to show up.
All right. Fair enough. All right. Last email, and then we'll get back to the phones at 800-348-2551. This is another one that I would ask. Ken writes, why is a perpetual motion machine impossible?
Well, one of the bedrock fundamental principles in science is the first law of thermodynamics. And it says that energy, other than nuclear energy, can be neither created nor destroyed. You just move it around. So a perpetual motion machine is one that generates useful work forever, and it violates that fundamental principle of basically that there is no free lunch.
Right.
You can't get something for nothing in terms of the energy.
Well, fair
enough. Now, as far as motion forever, I mean, in the weightlessness of space and in a vacuum, if you set something rotating, it will rotate essentially forever because there's nothing to slow it down. But you can't get any kind of useful work out of it. If you tried to run a generator with that rotating wheel, it would just slow down and stop.
It's the science forum
today.
The
same, yeah.
Go ahead,
it's
Barbara.
The same idea as the battery of that radio, right? There's only so much chemical energy that's stored in that battery, and if you expend more of it, you'll not have as much. It's always the zero-sum game. So same is true with rotational motion or frictional losses. They all add up to whatever you started with.
Barbara Rabbits is here. Jim Pickett is here. It's the Science Forum. 800-348-2551 is the number. Let's go back to the phones. Charles in Oneonta. Charles.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was up in the high peaks of the Adirondacks last week at sunrise up on top of Mount Colvin, and there was a rainbow. And I'm wondering if it's possible that we were high enough in elevation that we could see the rainbow begin to curve kind of under us. As we were looking from our peak towards, like, Mount Marcy, the rainbow was vertical. And as it approached a lake that was probably 2,000 feet below us, it seemed to actually curve inwards. Is that possible?
Sure.
Yeah, yeah. Go ahead, Jim.
There are a couple of effects that you can see from a mountaintop. Well, one would be the diffraction of the light from, say, ice particles in the air or anything that's dispersed in the air that can bend the light, that will give you a rainbow effect. You can also get diffraction around an object, and that's called a glory, which is the common thing to see from mountaintops down on clouds. You see it sometimes in airplanes, and that's the light bending around you if you have your back toward the sun. And then it makes a rainbow effect that may appear on a cloud below. If you were seeing the rainbow effect in the air, then it was probably from ice particles or little droplet, water droplets in the air. And from a high place, you would actually see it as a circle, I think.
Okay, I've actually seen a glory before in the peaks. One time was actually in one, which was an incredible thing. But I'd never quite seen a rainbow bend inward below us like that before. That was why I asked the question.
Yeah, and that's because you can... I'm pretty sure the rainbow... Rainbows should be complete circles, but because the ground gets in the way, you only see part of the circle.
Gotcha.
When you see kind of a regular rainbow. But if you're on a mountaintop looking into a valley, then you can see more of the circle.
And I would just add that sunrise is a great time to see it because you've got so much water hanging in the air from the overnight hours. Mm. Now the sun is coming out, and you haven't quite burned off that moisture from the dew from overnight. So that gives you those critical water droplets in order to see the rainbow.
Charles, thank you for the call. It's the Science Forum on WAMC Vox Pop. The number to call is 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. And Chris is in Castleton. Chris, you're on.
Yes, thank you. I have a question about the Grand Quai in Paris. It changed weight compared to the other reference kilograms that were around the globe, and they had to redefine what a kilogram was. And my question is, given, you know, the different densities depending on where you are on the globe, wouldn't the weight of a kilogram change based on whether you're on a big slab of magma or whether you are on a ship over water or whether you're on a sandy beach or whether it's high tide or low tide? You know, the weight change that I read about was so infinitesimal, I would think that a kilogram would weigh something different depending on where it was on the globe.
Hmm.
So I was wondering if you could just kind of expand on what the heck was happening and why.
Do you want to do that one, Barbara?
Don't know, or
do
you
want...
Well, you know, I've read about why they reestablished the gram, a kilogram, and I have forgotten what the distinction was, but I think it was to take the gravitational effect away.
All right, so that's homework for you.
Well,
you can follow up on
that. That's part of... I can expand on this a little more. The weight and mass are easily confused. So the Grand Quai is really defined as a mass. That is the amount of stuff that's there. And the way that you compare other masses to it is with a two-pan balance. So that means that the gravitational force is exactly the same on the two sides of that two-pan balance. So gravity is eliminated from that when you're doing measurements that way.
My understanding, however, was that they brought them together and they were different weights. Is that is my memory correct on that?
Yeah. Now, stuff. I mean, an object like that can change mass for all sorts of reasons. It can oxidize a little bit, although this alloy isn't supposed to do that. And I don't think they really understood why the Grand Quai was moving relative to the other ones. Because you're right, it was a very, very, very small amount. So the problem has since been finessed by defining the kilogram on the basis of essentially electricity.
Okay.
That could be measured.
Is it possible Is it possible that there were just improvements in measurements and they were able to be more accurate in the weights?
Well, no, because they were comparing it relative to the secondary standards. So you have the grand K in Paris, but then you had a less grand K, say, at the National Institute of Standards and Technology, the old National Bureau of Standards.
Chris, thank you.
And, go ahead. And there were those in other countries, too. But the grand K was moving relative to those secondary standards, and that was the concern.
All I can think of is the Pulp Fiction scene. The grand K just reminds me of that. Let's go to Bob in Florida, New York. Bob, you're on.
Yeah, this is a kind of a historical question about like Alamogordo and the atom bomb. I was just wondering how they actually calculated the critical mass of uranium before they ever like blew anything up, and how certain were they that they were right?
Yeah.
Well, you can always overestimate, but boy, that's going to be a bad day.
You betcha.
Yeah. That's why they put all those smart people in one place in Los Alamos. That's beyond me.
Okay, Barbara, you want to give it a shot? I know Ed Stander would give it a shot, but
He would. He's probably yelling at the radio right now, Ray.
Absolutely.
My distant memory of how this all played out had to do with increasing the density of what was possible to be sustained using the magic numbers that we know of that exist with heavy metal nuclei. So there's a ratio of protons to neutrons that kind of sets you into a stable isotope. And then if you go to either side of that triangle of stability by either overloading on neutrons or overloading on protons, you end up being radioactive. Well, if you kind of stuff the sock too full by imploding these materials into one another, that's how you get to a critical mass so that you can have a nuclear explosion. And I think they did some density calculations as to what that would look like, and then they winged it.
Okay.
So to speak.
All right.
That's my slaughter at attempting to explain something without a blackboard, a reference in front of me, or Ed Stander telling me I'm wrong.
Where's Ivor Gaver when you need him, right? You know,
he
would have been all over that one. Our number is 800-348-2551. Andy in Kingston. Andy, you're on.
Yes, I have a question that was raised on the bird show yesterday.
Yes.
About the chickens lay an egg every day, but other birds only
a couple times a year.
Every 6 months or so.
Yeah. We heard that question yesterday, and I figure Barbara might have a shot at this.
Well, what was the question? Why chickens and nobody else?
Well, basically, somebody said, why do domesticated chickens lay eggs all the time, essentially, whereas their cousins out in the wild only do it once or twice a year?
Well, okay. It's kind of a nature and a nurture. So we'll go with the nurture part first. Any kind of fertility, whether in an animal or even in a plant for that matter, is often hormonally regulated. So what happens in commercial chicken operations is that those hormones are part of the feed that the animals get so that they're effectively more fertile than they would be if they were just Joe Chicken walking down the road. Mm. If you hormonally load the feed, then you're going to hormonally load the chicken, and then the chicken is going to overexpress, and in this case, it's going to lay more eggs. And you can over hormonally regulate a chicken to the point where they will get what is called egg bound, where they'll create an egg that's so large that it can't come out of the cloaca, rear end of the chicken, and it is a fatal day for that chicken, for sure. Or sometimes you can get double yolks, or you can get extra large or jumbo eggs. So, you know, if your chickens live well and eat well and have those hormonal triggers, you will find that they will lay larger eggs and more eggs. If you look at an organic farm where they don't give those hormonal triggers, then the foodstuffs that they give them have the precursors to those hormones in the plant material that they feed the chicken. So that kind of the building blocks, the Legos of those hormones are in the diet, so then the chicken can manufacture the hormone internally. But
right.
they're not usually – try finding jumbo organic eggs. It's a tough thing to find.
Interesting. All right,
ultimately, we've got thousands of years of selection to get to the point where a chicken is more productive.
All right, let's take a quick break.
And one of the keys is that the eggs are taken away from the chicken every day.
Yeah.
If the chicken is allowed to make a clutch of eggs, it'll stop laying and just hatch those eggs out.
It'll feel content and everything will be fine. All right, let's take a break here. 800-348-2551 is the number. Science Forum via the telephone. We'll be right back. It's the Vox Pop Science Forum, 800-348-2551. Barbara Bravitz and Jim Pickett are here, and they're on the phone. And, you know, you've been doing these now for a while via the telephone. Not as easy to get it done, and I appreciate you both being here. I got an email a little while ago from Barbara from home who wrote, "Hey, Bales, if you want to open a can of worms, I had some homework from February. I have no... What did we talk about with hay bales, Barbara?"
Oh, I'm so glad you don't remember.
Oh, I have no... Well, now you got to talk
about it.
All right, go ahead.
We talked about the difference between round and rectangular hay bales, and specifically the farm wrap that goes around round bales, and what the round wrap is trying to accomplish. Mm. And so there was a bit of... difference between our panel with our experience level of whether we're trying to keep moisture out or whether we're trying to keep moisture in.
Oh, yeah.
In those round bales.
Right.
And so I did my homework. I talked to my colleagues and they sent me to the Ohio State website. Sorry, SUNY, to find out more about moisture content. So your typical rectangular hay bale should have no more than 22% moisture in it. Otherwise, it will start molding.
Yeah.
And ultimately will heat up from the microbial degradation inside and could catch fire in a barn.
Right.
Large rectangular hay bales, which we see these days because we don't have people throwing them anymore. We have machines throwing them. These are humongous ones that are the size of like a kitchen table. They can be no more than 16% moisture because they're so dense and they're so large that you get hotter temperatures in the core and they'll still degrade and they'll still catch on fire.
Oh.
So you can't do more than 16% moisture with a large rectangle. Large round bales are somewhere in between in size, and therefore no more than 18% moisture is recommended. But what you can do is if you're at that 18% moisture and you want to create silage, that is, you want to intentionally ferment your hay bale.
Yes.
Which is a foodstuff. You put that round wrap out. You have that 15 or so percent moisture. You wrap it and then you leave it there. And then what you've got is a little mini silo, which will create silage within the round bale. You'll still have some loss. For every 1% of decrease in moisture, you lose 1% of the dry matter within the hay bale. But yeah. What it can do is save you from having to build another silo or another silo bunker by having each one of those little marshmallows out there in the field.
Oh, you don't say. Well, note to self.
I don't say.
Never answer note Barbara's emails during the program.
Right.
It's hey, do you think that this sheds any light on spontaneous human combustion?
Well, I am not taking that one as homework. Let me put it that way.
All right, fair enough. Let's go back to the phones. 800-348-2551 is the number. Matt in Northampton. Matt, you're on.
Hello?
Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
Hello.
Okay, I didn't think, I thought my question was going to be recorded, but let's see, it's a epistemological question about science and what we know and what we don't know, and a lot of my educated friends are fearful of what we don't know, and often especially regarding genetic engineering in herbicides, and I just wonder what the panel thinks about how much we should be afraid of what we don't know when we know a lot about, for example, the loss of floral diversity when it comes to invasive species, what we know a lot about macronutrient availability or non-availability in the developing world, as in the case of genetic engineering. We know for sure that those are huge problems. And the approach of, well, we don't know the effects of herbicides, or we don't know the effects of genetic engineering, seems to me to be sound like an ultra-precautionary approach, when in any field of science, if you drill down far enough, there's a vast or infinite amount of things we don't know. So it's an epistemological question about acting or not acting based upon the quantity of information we have.
The answer is, I don't know. No, go ahead, Barbara. You go first, and then Jim, you go second.
Well, we talk about this, and I teach a ethics in science, technology, engineering, and medicine course, and we talk about that idea of fear of the unknown, and we try to switch it up because fear is an emotional response, and I think there's a quantifying the impact of the unknown, right? There are some unknowns that are trivial. I'll give you an example. I don't know what Ray Graff would do if I showed up next time wearing pink hair.
Oh,
okay?
I would say, you look like part of my family. Yeah, that'd be great.
Right. Okay, now I know. But say I don't know what his reaction would be. What I as a scientist need to say is, how much does that unknown matter in the scheme of things, right? So we have to weigh the impact of the unknown. So if his response is a big deal, say it's my boss,
right?
And maybe my boss doesn't like pink hair, then I'm going to have a different impact to that unknown versus whether it's Ray.
Yeah.
And I know it's a silly example, but it gets to the point that we have to always in science anticipate the impact of the unknown and how much it weighs what we do. So we would not, for example, perform COVID immunization experiments on newborns because the unknown of what could happen to that newborn has a much bigger impact on society than the unknown of doing the same on a grown adult.
Interesting. Jim, you want to weigh in?
A lifetime of effect and all that. What do you do to the arc of life of that individual? What about autonomy and having someone make a decision for somebody else? All of those things factor in. They're the same unknown. We don't know what's going to happen, but the impact of that unknown is different. So I guess I'd leave it there and welcome Jim's comment.
Jim.
Yeah, I agree with what Barbara said, that you work through about what the risks are, what you don't know, what possible outcomes could result from doing something. And a key part of that is to have people with different experiences and different expertise sitting around the table while that's going on, and to try to anticipate what the consequences would be, and how big, what's the worst case scenario if something goes seriously wrong. Now, there again, you're never going to be 100% right all the time, but it's a matter of reducing the risk.
The number to call here on this program is 800-348-2551. It's the Science Forum with Barbara Brabets and Jim Pickett. And let's go to George in Connecticut. George, you're on.
Yeah, hi. I have a question about magnets and when they attract each other. I'm assuming, from what I understand, they attract at the speed of light. I take the magnets out of my hard drive, and I think they're ferrite magnets, and they just are super strong, and I'm wondering how quickly they connect.
Well, it could be calculated from the mass of the magnets and the force of attraction, because they will accelerate together. The magnetic field propagates at the speed of light, but the rate at which the magnets move is good old Newtonian physics, depending again on the mass of the magnets and the strength.
Mass times acceleration equals force. Yep.
Yep.
But wouldn't there also be the factor of friction in the air?
Sure.
Or if it was in water, you know, something like that. All right, yeah. George, thanks a lot. 800-348-2551, the Science Forum. Let's go over to Pittsfield, Massachusetts. Brian, you're on.
Hi, how's it going? Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
Okay, so I'm looking up at the hillsides here, and I see a whole lot of swath of dead ash trees from the emerald ash borer. What's going to happen to this bug after it runs out of ash trees? Is it going to adapt to eat something else or breed?
Ah.
Yeah, do the ash trees have a chance of coming back sometime in the future?
Hmm. Well, this is a terrific question because it kind of goes back to the last question, the philosophical question about what we know and what we don't know and what do we fear. We don't necessarily know what will happen when the ash trees die out, but we can surmise what happened in other populations will happen here. So as those trees die out, like what happened with the American chestnut, there'll be, if there's a time that there are no chestnuts, then you can now bring back the American chestnut and the pathogen is no longer around.
Well, that'd be good.
So, but how long is that time?
Yeah.
Decades?
For example, with Dutch elm disease, I mean, the elms are pretty well wiped out. But
yeah, but
if you plant an elm now, it'll get to adolescent size and then will perish from Dutch elm disease. So somehow there's still a reservoir of that. And I think the American chestnut is about the same way. Can't tell.
Yep.
Right. Well, the bug, though, is a different organism. It's an actual insect.
Right. It's so an insect, which actually gives you a better chance of being able to reestablish after a period in time, right? So if there's no other reservoir that they can go into, that's it. After a decade or so, those bugs are not going to have any means of being alive in any form in the soil or in the fallen trees.
Hmm.
The problem we have is that we transport dead wood around all the time.
Yeah.
So just like coronavirus getting on a plane and moving across the world in 2 weeks, the same can be done with wood. In fact, Asian longhorn beetle came here to the United States on Chinese pallets. So it turns out it was wood, pallet wood, that was for commercial transport of large, heavy material. And that's how a lot of it got to the Northeast.
Hmm. All right, we only have a couple of... Go ahead, Jim.
Just saying, it wasn't the beetle flying across the ocean. We did it all ourselves.
Right. Jim, did you want to add something there?
Nope.
Okay. A couple of minutes here. I'll try to go through a couple of more calls. 800-348-2551. Gerard in New Paltz, you're on.
Good afternoon, folks. Thank you for taking my call. A simple question. I have a farm implement which is run by a tractor. Now, the farm implement, it cuts grass. It's called a flail mower. Now, there's two pulleys on it. There's the drive pulley, which operates the, so to speak, work pulley to cut the grass. They're both 8 inches in diameter. What I'd like to do is reduce the RPMs that I need to run on the tractor to make the farm implement effectively cut the grass properly. If I reduce the work pulley, let's say down to 6 inches, will it turn that shaft and that working shaft faster?
Yes. Yep.
Okay.
Yep, there's more, but the force on that pulley is more.
Yeah. So you'll you'll need more torque to
Okay. All right. Well, what I'm doing is it's not rough material, but it's just grass and it can be used for more rough stuff. And I think that's what the design was for, to go into more rougher stuff like some brush and stuff. I'm just doing grass. And to save the life of the tractor, that's why I'm considering reducing the size of the pulley. So thank you very much for answering my question, and I appreciate this forum.
Well, thanks a lot for the call.
Could I just interject in that maybe you want to trace out what the pulley looked like, the new size one that you're going to get, in case you need to have another one manufactured in slightly stronger material.
That makes good sense. All right, we only have 30 seconds here. Let's go to Mike in Post-and-Kill. Mike, you got to make it quick, okay?
Absolutely. Thank you. If you have a window fan in a window and a really strong wind blows and turns the blades in the window fan, is there the potential for the fan to send electricity back down the cord?
I don't think so.
Yeah, I love that.
I don't
that.
Think so either, but I would love to do that. I mean, I had an old...
That's a great question.
Not so great, obviously, but it's a great homework.
Yeah, it is.
Because you could take an old fan and... Somebody put their hands into harm's way and move it backwards and see what happens on the other end of the plug.
All right, Mike, thanks. All right, quick email here. We only have 20 seconds here. Carol writes...
That one is homework. Yeah.
All right, please explain why when you drop the first piece of pasta into boiling water, the water bubbles up and seems to boil bigger and faster around it, then settles down in about 10 seconds. Who wants it?
You've superheated the water, in which it's a little bit more... Well, and actually, you're doing two things. The water could have been superheated. If it's already boiling, what it is air that's trapped on the pasta is providing sights for the bubbles to form.
Oh, very interesting. All right, we'll leave it there. Yep. Barbara Brabitz and Jim Pickett, thanks for being here, you both. And hopefully next time, yeah, Barbara, you can come in with the pink hair and we'll see you in person.
Awesome.
Support comes from Ambrose Electric Standby Power, an electrical contractor providing sales service and installation of residential and commercial Generac automatic standby generators, serving the greater Capital District for over 40 years, AmbroseLEC.com. At Merritt Bookstore, Millbrook, porch pickup and deliveries available, plus an updated website with orders processed daily, books, journals, brain-based games, and more, MerrittBookstore.com. Once again, thanks to Jim Pickett and Barbara Brabitz for being here. Thank you for listening. Terrific calls today. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Amber Sickles took the calls. Our producer is Jackie Orchard. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, two special guests on the line. Famous people to talk about Polish food. Jane Kaczmarek is here, will be here, and Beata Pochniak. Yeah, they're famous, and they're going to be on my show tomorrow, and I've got performance anxiety. We'll make it through. We'll see you tomorrow at 2:00.